Welcome, everybody, to episode 79 of Underserved. Today with me in studio, I have Shani Gentry-Sincotti, Senior Manager of Data Services at Point 32 Health. Let's get started.
Welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry, where we focus on stories of tech industry leaders, their insights, and their lessons learned. And now, your host, Andrew Jalina.
Shani, thank you so much for joining us on Underserved.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
So I think you're the first Alabama native that we've had on the show. Like, what was it like growing up there? Was there much tech to be had?
Oh, gosh. Well, if I'm the first Alabama native to grace your studio, let me just give you a hearty roll tide.
Roll tide.
I would say there was not a lot. My parents jointly ran the local weekly newspaper in my hometown when I grew up, and they started that before I was born. Around the time I was 4 or 5, they got their first computer. They had larger equipment before that that we would still call cold type. But they started out with an Apple II when I was 4 or 5, and I had some cute little games for that. So starting with that and after that, I always had computers around that I could use when they were free.
Were you like doing any programming on them or Logo or playing games? What'd you like about it?
I had games. I was doing a little bit of basic programming. I played a lot of games.
Do you remember your favorite?
It was called Craws. I think it was a ripoff of Zork.
Ah.
And unfortunately did not play well with processor upgrades, but it was a cute little dungeon game.
And so you end up going to school in-state at the famous?
University of Alabama, Roll Tide.
What was that like?
It's a very big school. There were 19,000 undergraduates in the years that I was there and some 10,000 or so upperclassmen. So it was a good place to be anonymous in a crowd. There were smaller groups that I was a part of. I was part of the Men's and Women's Honor Society, which was definitely fun. There were a lot of computer labs. Some of them were open 24/7, and I had cause to know that. I took a major in journalism, minors in history and English, and I did not take any technical classes at all.
You must have made it to some football games, though.
I made it to a few. At that time, the student tickets were readily available for, I think, $16 a ticket. You could get them on the weekly basis or you could pre-order. And there's a huge student section. This was around the end of Gene Stallings' tenure. And he was a powerhouse, but not a Bear Bryant or Nick Saban powerhouse. He had a couple of national championships, and then he retired midway through my career there.
Only two? For shame.
No.
Now, was it kind of seeing your parents and them publishing? Was that what got you interested in journalism or something else?
I love telling people stories. I am desperately resisting interviewing you right now. So
you're a journalism major. What happens like as you get towards the end of school?
Well, we had a fundamental moment in my development. There was a work fair that they had gotten publishers from small weekly and daily newspapers from around the South in, and they basically got us into a room and said, you'll never make any money at this. You'll be lucky if we pay you $15,000 a year to string. You'll never be able to pay your bills. And then there was an undertone of, and also we really don't want any women on our staff. Thank you.
Way to sell it, guys.
I know, right? This was the 90s. I thought we already had all that done, but I should have picked up on the clues earlier. I decided that might not be for me. I had taken a work-study job earlier with the Crimson White, which is the student newspaper on campus, well-regarded, and at that time was publishing 4 or 5 days a week, and I was their first web editor, and we were doing what we call at that point scraping, you know, cutting and pasting into a template. We were not developing anything directly for web, but still it was a point, and I looked at this and I thought, you know, I could probably make a little money doing this. And I thought it might be web design. I was lucky enough to have some close friends that lived in Boston. I came up here after I graduated. I did that thing that so many people do where you have 8 or 9 unrelated people all living together in a giant house in Alston. And I was lucky enough after a couple of seasons of temping to fall in with a small software company called Merlin One. The CEO of that company, David Tannenbaum, is a native of the AP. he was a former Stringer photographer and then a line photographer in the AP. And he had written some software tools and also some accompanying hardware that would assist people on the road in filing their stories and filing their photos. And by the time I came along, the company was 10 years old and their primary product was a photo archive. This later grew into video, some text, PDFs, various kinds of media. But at the time that I was there, it was largely JPEGs coming off of the professional cameras and TIFFs that had been scanned from film cameras.
Okay, so I'm a photographer. I work for the Globe, or I'm a photographer and I'm a freelancer and trying to get images sold to the Globe. How am I kind of interacting with Merlin One software?
Oh, you might have used a tool called Scrounger to dump the files off of your cards or to dump in the images from your scans. And then you would have put IPTC metadata onto them. And then you would have dropped them into a hot folder and they would have come into our system complete with the metadata.
I don't have to fool around with FTP or anything. The stuff just kind of flies
you
under the radar.
You could have done. There were, for remote locations, there were certainly FTP drops. They may have been personalized to the photographer and they may have been more generalized.
I've watched some YouTube videos where like pro sports photographers talk about their workflow and like taking pictures and hurrying up and then in between plays, like trying to upload stuff so it could be timely for the web and the papers. Is it that sort of scramble back then?
Absolutely. It was absolutely that kind of scramble. And the worst thing that could happen, I say these days, you don't want to end up on the front page of the Boston Globe. But our worst nightmare was that the Boston Globe wouldn't have a photo on its front page. Or the New York Times, or one of our other high-profile customers.
And so do you travel as part of working for them?
Yes, I traveled a great deal. This was largely before companies had VPNs readily available, let alone for their vendors. This is before RSA made their mark in the key fobs that we all carried around a dozen of only 5 years later. I traveled loosely around the world. Primarily, our customers at that time were in English-speaking locations. I did a couple of trips to Australia, a few to Europe. One of my favorite trips that we ever made was we had a small customer in Albury, New South Wales, and they were a daily paper and are still a daily paper, which is a big deal in these times. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to do a software upgrade from our 3 version to our 4 version. And at the time, none of this hosting arrangement software as a service was even thought of. So this was all on site, had to be done by a person on site. And they wanted it done during the middle of the Sydney Olympics. And I have no idea why they made that choice, but that is what they wanted. So we scrambled around and got me a passport and got me a flight. And our reseller in Sydney wanted me to do a couple of days worth of demos to local customers. And I said, sure, I'll be your sales engineer. That's fine. What they couldn't find was a hotel room. So they ended up making some phone calls around and put me up in a women's hostel that was attached to the local convent. And I had a fun time navigating with a suitcase as big as a bus just off the photogenic harbor bridge on the North Sydney side, wandering around at 8 or 9 o'clock at night, trying to figure out where I was supposed to go. Because this isn't lit up like your Holiday Inn. This is a convent.
It's like a speakeasy.
Yes, it was very much like a speakeasy. And I hope they'll forgive me for saying that.
How was it hanging out with the sisters?
It was very quiet. There were no amenities, no television. It was a communal shower area. It was fine. It was all we needed. And I was relieved to have had some kind of solution. And then we went down to Albury and did a couple of days there. We had banked 3 days for the upgrade and 1 or 2 for training. And we got lucky and everything went really smooth. And we were done a day early. And the guy I was working with said, hey, it's Sunday. You don't have to work. Do you want to go wine tasting with my wife and I? And I said, of course, absolutely. And I've been wine tasting ever since.
Very nice. Well, that's a good place to start.
I thought so.
You are listening to the Underserved Podcast. Underserved is produced by Syrinx, the developer-founded, developer-run software consulting company. For more information, visit syrinx.com. That's syrinx.com.
Now, your products there were also supporting like photographers covering the Oval Office as well, right?
That is also correct. We landed our first installation in the Oval Office with George W. Bush's administration. And that was a big win for us. Eric Draper, who was the lead photographer for the White House Press Corps. And of course, it was his decision. And he had known the owner of our company and other people from our company from previous work. And he had the opportunity to demo out the software, chose it, and we were just ecstatic at the exposure. What we had not really thought about was the logistics of how this was going to work, because in those days, the software was usually about two or three servers. We had the back-end server engine, the indexing, the database, the storage, and then we probably also had one just for the ingestion and the FTP locations, as you had mentioned. What we had to do in this case was install the whole works on dedicated hardware at a nearby Air Force base. And of course, it was behind locked doors. This was just after 9/11. It's very stressful to fly in and out of Washington. There were machine guns on people everywhere. So that's a new experience to come into work, surrender your cell phone, have all your bags looked over, and there are people with automatic weapons.
That's pretty standard.
I guess it depends on what your standard is.
Now, they didn't just manage like photos and JPEGs. It was like valuable images from anywhere, including like Marvel Comics, right?
We did manage the archive for Marvel prior to its acquisition for Disney. Another big name one that we were managing at the time was personally owned by Bill Gates. And they had offices in New York and in Bellingham, Washington. This was Corbis, and they had bought multiple photo archives. One of the things that I found when I was rooting around in their offices in New York was an original glass negative of Abraham Lincoln.
Wow.
And the archive has since been sold. I guess this was a passion project for Mr. Gates. It was an honor and a privilege to help them with their scanning and with their digital needs. They had a great crew. They had great assets, too. They were really
serious collectors.
They were serious collectors, but they were handling part of our nation's history, part of the world's history. They had the UPI archives, which was Universal Press International, and they were sort of the competitor to the AP for all those years.
Mm. Well, there's been some hubbub recently about, you know, what are you allowed to take from the White House versus what belongs to the people?
You know, I had noticed a little bit of furor about that. Unless you're exposed to it, you might not realize that the assets of the president belong to the office of the president. There are things that come with the office that do not attach to the person, be it man or woman, who holds the office. The bulk of it, and in the photo archive, Every time there is a change of administration, there are hundreds of people working in the background to bring the assets out and bring new assets in. And that could mean furniture. That could mean linens and china. That could mean, you know, personal effects. But that also, in our case, meant the digital effects. So we had someone on site to do that transformation, to detach the database and the digital assets and reattach a blank set and set it up for his successor, Mr. Obama, and then detach all of that and send it over to where it would eventually become part of the presidential library. The George W. Bush Presidential Library is in Dallas, just off the SMU campus. If you ever want to visit that archive, I have done. You have to make an appointment, but you can do it.
That's cool. What makes you want to move on from Merlin One?
The travel eventually got to me. It was a great job with a lot of great clients, and I was on the road easily 2 to 3 weeks out of a month. I applied for a graduate program. I got in, and around the same time, before I knew that I was going to get in, I was applying for other jobs that would keep me locally, and I fell in with a software company up in Bedford that was doing incentive compensation management, and at the time I joined, it was called Centiv.
And what were you doing at Centiv?
What I was doing for Centiv was managing their technical support. I was managing their CRM system. I was managing our lower environments and making sure they were in good heart, and also helping our customers conduct upgrades, which was not done face-to-face. By then, we were doing it all through VPN.
You found one time that increasing hardware actually made things slower?
Yes. It was a little finicky. This was a platform of software that didn't do anything out of the box. It was 60% functional, but what you had to do as a customer was determine what your rules were and then have people build them out mathematically to slip into the system. And if they weren't tuned well, they could run for many hours. And if they were tuned well, still they could run for some time. We had a high-profile customer that needed to run their processes every day and compound their gains every day. And so they were very invested in this taking place in less than an hour if it could. We recommended some hardware to them. At that time, we were recommending Sun Microsystem Spark boxes. We recommended them an 8-processor server for their Oracle host. They said if 8's good, 16's going to be better. So they bought 16, and unfortunately, it was not better. It was over-parallelized. At the end of the day, we offered them an option of you can turn off half your processors, let them sit idle in the box. Oracle doesn't know anything about them. And we can get this to run in 35 minutes. But if you need to use all of them, it's not going to run in less than an hour and a half. And for political reasons, they had to use all the processors because they'd spent all the money.
Oh.
Yeah.
So speaking of political decisions or non-optimal ones, didn't someone hear of a new language they wanted to develop in? So miraculously, the next project used Adobe Flex?
Funnily enough, when I started grad school, the very first course had a section in it about how to make business decisions. And it touched on not doing things just because you thought they might be cool. The company was trying to get away from the installed model where there was, you know, big iron on site. And they wanted to do software as a service. They wanted it to be web enabled. And they thought that the best tool to write that in would be Adobe Flex. And you might say, what? Because I don't think anyone knows what Adobe Flex is these days. It was pretty. And in the course of trying to make that foray a success, they ended up selling off their platform arm to a venture capitalist group who thought they could double it, triple it, make a lot of money off of it. And I ended up going with that acquisition.
So what happened then?
Well, we went out of business in about 18 months.
Ooh, what was that like?
Well, when we moved in, we were occupying a space that had been part of the real estate crisis, and it had looked like a fire sale. There were all evidences that people had left in a hurry, up to and including half-empty cups of coffee on desks, like people's personal effects. Clearly, the sheriff had turned up and turned these people out. And we were there for a year and change, and then I noticed that nobody was taking out the trash anymore. And then I realized that nobody was refilling the water coolers. And that's when I realized we were not paying rent. So I aggressively stepped up my job search and I got out, as I recall, 2 weeks before the doors closed.
And where do you end up next?
I ended up at a little health insurance company in Medford, Massachusetts called Network Health.
Oh, I've heard of them.
Have you?
What do they do?
Well, they are now part of a larger, you may have heard of Tufts Health Plan. They were acquired by Tufts Health Plan in 2011. Tufts Health Plan merged with Harvard Pilgrim in 2020 to become Point 32 Health. But when I started at Network Health, we were the prime purveyor of Medicaid services in the state of Massachusetts. And that's all we did. Then President Obama took office. We passed the Health Care Act, and we then started making all preparations to dip our toes in the new qualified health plan market, which people call Obamacare.
And what was that like, implementing that throughout the company?
It was fantastic. Network Health was a nonprofit. We had a nonprofit type mission. Everybody in the company was focused on that goal of delivering expanded healthcare coverage for the citizens of the Commonwealth.
I am altering the scope of the project. Pray I don't alter it any further.
Excellent. Let the scope creep flow. Keep adding features.
To deploy the release,
deliver first. You must.
I find your lack of faith in change management disturbing.
Missing your deadline is the path to the dark side.
If you or someone you know manages software development projects, we can help. Call the offices of Syrinx Consulting. Syrinx provides software consultants who hit the ground running to help you deliver right away. Our toll-free number is 888-579-7469, option 1. Or you can live chat with Berg at Syrinx.com. That's Syrinx.com.
Syrinx is not a law office and this is not legal advice. Offer valid only in the United States. Hablamos español, pero solo un poco y no tener ni pies ni cabeza. Saludos.
What's it like for you? Are you like one of the only people kind of managing the Wild West there on the database frontier?
I was the only person managing it. When I joined the company, they were looking for a full-time DBA who would also take charge of their change control, since most of their changes being affected were database data changes, and they had had some issues that they wanted a closer set of eyes on it. I was lucky enough that they had already been working for over a year with an outsourcer to provide the day-to-day database oversight and monitoring. But it was still 6 months before I slept through the night. I was managing over 75 SQL servers. Again, we didn't want to end up on the front page of the Boston Globe. So there was a lot of monitoring. And it was also the last job that I carried a pager for.
Oh, I remember beeper duty.
Oh, yeah.
Not fondly, but I remember it.
No, we all remember.
Anything noteworthy happen while you were managing all those 70-odd systems?
Oh, there was one day I took a day off unexpectedly because my best friend was having unplanned surgery and wanted me to be her medical proxy, and I couldn't say no. And at the time, you didn't bring cell phones into a hospital, really. They didn't want them. They could upset the equipment. So I was dark for a full 18 hours. I was back in the office the next day, and they did not want to tell me what had happened. And it turned out that one of the EDI specialists had been working directly on a server and saw something they didn't think ought to be there. I'm sure they thought it was their own desktop, and managed to uninstall the SQL server that handled all the incoming and outbound EDI files.
Huh.
And that was enough to bring us to our knees for some time. It was a nice test of our backup and recovery system, and it was successful.
Well, that's good.
Excitement that no one needed.
You mentioned in the pre-call that your boss, David, was great to work for around then. Any stories around that?
About 18 months into my tenure at Network Health, we had a great new director start, and he was fresh from Fresenius. He had all kinds of great ideas. Name is David Duby, and he's really been a mentor for me for that stage of my career. He did an inventory of what we had and what we didn't have. At that time, Network Health had had a close relationship with Cambridge Health Alliance, but it had just been severed. And we were now a standalone company with our own independent nonprofit status. And we had to rebuy everything. So we took a look at all the things we needed. We needed new network equipment. We had no wireless network. We had very little in the way of security protection for our assets. We needed new backup software. We needed training for HIPAA compliance, phishing, and all the other kind of annual training that we all have to go through. And David made a list, and he gave that list to my counterpart, Sherry, and I. And he said, go and shop. Go make a relationship with value-added resellers. Go figure out what we can get by with. But we need all these things, and we've got about 3 years to do it in. And we shopped. And that was the major part of my job. I hired another DBA to take care of the day-to-day work, and I started working with resellers. I was primarily working on the Microsoft contract, which that was quite a coup. And we bought all of those things. We bought test environment management software. We bought automation software. We bought the training tools that we needed. I learned a lot of security vocabulary, and that's still been one of the nicest challenges anybody ever gave to me.
Well, it's like being a kid in a candy store with a blank check.
Right. You're a 30-something in a candy store with a blank check.
What else were you working on after that? Like kind of figuring out where are we overpaying? How do we kind of trim costs and so on?
For sure. I was working on trying to figure out how we could cut our budgets back. We did some renegotiation. The Microsoft spend was a big one. There was a lot of stuff we wanted to use and were not entitled to use. So we ended up completely redoing how we did our desktop and server management licensing. We also we started engaging some contract workers because at that point we were mostly working with only full-time employees. I had been asked to form a small team of independent specialists, and that consisted of security and continuity and disaster recovery, project management, database administration, and some business analysis as well. It was a lot of odds and ends that needed to report somewhere, and we really made it work.
Did things change a lot during the acquisition by Tufts?
It changed 100%, not overnight, but in the first couple of years. We came to know that every place that companies could make decisions, even though they were in the same basic space, that Network Health and Tufts had made different decisions. all the way down to, you know, Nortel versus Cisco. And
who chose Cisco?
We had. It was a slow set of changes for the most part. The first thing to go was security. It got folded into the main security group and then backups and continuity. And then after that, it was going to be project management and business analysis. And at that point, all I would be running was the QA team, which also had a big team that it was going to become part of. And I was trying to figure out what was next for me when the manager for our data warehouse got a fantastic opportunity. And I was told by the gentleman who was going to be my boss at the time, Bill Papalardo, you can apply for other roles or you can agree to manage this for some time. We'll see how you do. And there might be other opportunities in the future. And I said, you know, I've always loved databases. And that was not sarcastic. I've always loved databases, and I really enjoyed working with the people on that team. I agreed to do that. And within the next few months, another manager left, and I agreed to run those teams as well. So I had data warehousing, analytics, and reporting, which in the healthcare space, reporting is very often government-focused.
And what are you up to today? Like, where is the company going, and what are you doing?
I'm still managing that data warehouse. But it is on a track to retirement, and we expect to be able to stop all the feeds coming into it sometime next year. I am advising on how that can be done along with a team whose full-time job it is. I am consulting on a project to replace our pharmacy benefit management partner. I am also working on some initiatives within our data management group to determine our directions on putting together the teams that were Tufts Health Plan and the teams that were Harvard Pilgrim to become a solid .32 health data management team.
How did life change for you and other folks there on March 13th, 2020?
Well, you've got to remember, we didn't work remote before then. There was very little remote work in the IT department because the leadership at the time, all at this point retired, didn't really like it. They liked to see the people in front of them. And so one thing that we did have going for us was that after the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy, the company made a directional change with regard to business continuity that we would all have issued laptops. It didn't matter who you were. You no longer had a desktop computer. Prior to that, you had to be somebody to get a laptop. I had always had one because I was always on call or managing people who were on call. But that was not true of a claims processor or a member services representative. We had an interim solution where we published our apps through Citrix, and you could use that from a personal computer. That was pretty short-lived. It didn't have the flexibility we had hoped. So going into the COVID pandemic, we did at least have our laptops, and we did have a robust VPN system and security on that. The Friday the 13th before the pandemic was a big scramble of me, you know, gently reminding everyone, please take all the food out of your desk. Please don't leave your plants here. Please take your dock. Take your keyboard. You may not be back here for a while.
Yeah, everyone's like, oh, 2 weeks.
Oh, yeah. Everybody thought it was going to be 2 weeks. I was like, it's going to be 2 years. And I was pretty close. The very first day that my husband and I both left our house to go to a workplace together on the same day was 2.5 years later.
Wow.
It was the 13th of September.
Are there any hobbies that you're passionate about?
Well, I took up one during the pandemic that I am quite passionate about. I have a bike. It's a hybrid. It's not a racing bike. And I feel like I've found just about every rail trail in Massachusetts and southern Maine and New Hampshire. I log a lot of hours after work and over the weekends. This upcoming weekend, we're going to do the Northern Strand, which takes you from Everett all the way up to Lynn.
Yeah.
So that's nice.
You do some sewing too as well, right?
I do. I've been a quilter for some 20 years. It's something that my maternal grandmother had always done, and I have many of her objects of art, which are also useful objects to own. I've made several. And right now I'm treating myself to a class to rediscover how to actually use a sewing machine. So when you say, hey, Shani, didn't you just say you've been quilting for 20 years? All of that was done by hand.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a lot of love and little blood in everything that I did. But I am a few weeks into a course to learn how to use my sewing machine, make a garment, set a zipper, and I'm hoping that I will pick up my next project that way. I have something planned. It's pandemic related.
My mom was very into quilting when she was alive, and she was a sewing machine quilter. And I always thought it was interesting how it's partly, you know, left brain, like, all right, line this stuff up exactly right and do it over and over, and partly right brain, like, how do you make this into a beautiful pattern as well as a nicely insulating blanket?
Right, it's color and math all at the same time.
Yeah, that's cool. Is there anything that you're passionate about as far as advocacy, philanthropy, anything like that?
Ever since the experience that I had mentioned back in college, getting the general idea that my professors and the people practicing in that industry really didn't want women in it, I was sensitive to the place of women in the workplace. And particularly after I started Network Health, I realized that in the health sector, you tend to have a lot of women. Point 32 Health, as it stands right now, is 70% women among its full-time employees. It's not in the IT department. Back in 2019, at a suggestion from our HR department, some other senior managers and I got together to form the Women in Technology Circle within our organization. It's an employee resource group. And we have spent a lot of time during the pandemic having, you know, programming around advocating for yourself, learning how to brand, stopping apologizing for taking up space. And it's been a thing that I am really passionate about, because at this point in my career, nearly 25 years in, I feel like I can say I have made it. And it is time for me, at my point in the ladder, to turn around and see who's behind me and give them a hand up if I can.
Are you doing some mentoring around that?
I have been doing mentoring. I have also been lucky enough to be a mentee at different points, but I am also working to make sure that we have effective hiring practices on various points of diversity. And this is also a mission of the company.
When you were a mentee, what is one of the most memorable things you picked up?
My mentor's name is Jill, and she listened to a problem that I was having, and she said, "What you're seeing is real, and this is what you can do about it." But I think a lot of people just want to hear that they're seeing something that's real out there, that I didn't just imagine how I was treated. I didn't just imagine that somebody interrupted me during a meeting. I didn't just imagine that somebody took credit for my work.
And is that something that, as a mentor, that you are trying to help those folks who are still coming up the ladder?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And to remind them they always should negotiate their salary offers. One of the things that I had in mind in between the acquisition of Network Health by Tufts Health Plan and the formation of Point 32 Health, which I could never have foreseen, was waiting for some changes in leadership. Because as I mentioned, things felt a little out of date. And we were lucky enough to get in for one of our major implementation projects, a very dynamic leader whose name is Selma Ferhat-Begovic-Fidi. And she is now our CIO. And I respect her so much. She has so much insight into the problems that we can hit both at the micro and the macro level. She and I were talking earlier this week about a situation we had had a few years earlier where our COO's son could not, through a flaw in some eligibility process, was at the point of sale for getting a flu shot and couldn't get it. I think that's the last thing you want any of our members to experience.
Let alone one of the executive's kids.
Right. But that's the way that things can blow up with no notice and go all the way to the top of the organization. So I think it's amazing how she can keep her finger on the pulse of so many different things and understand them both. This is what the executives are going to want to hear, but this is what I need to hear from the technologists.
The higher you are on the pyramid, the more you have to look around.
Oh, absolutely. She's just such a great example of a dynamic and thoughtful leader. And she's made some wonderful hires as well. We have a couple of vice presidents that I really enjoy working with.
Excellent. Shani, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your experiences with the listeners of Underserved.
Well, thank you, Andrew. I can't think of any other way I'd like to spend a rainy Thursday afternoon. It's been wonderful speaking with you.
And we'll talk to everyone soon on the next episode of Underserved.
Thank you for listening to the Underserved podcast. For more information on the topics discussed and for show notes, visit the show website, underserved.fm. And please be sure to rate, like, and subscribe to Underserved on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.